what is it good for? Hey everybody, welcome to In Context. You are listening to WPKN. This is, as I said, In Context, WPKN's weekly public affairs call-in show. My name is Gus Cantavero. I'm here with my co-host, Ken McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon.
And behind the board is Marshawn McDermott Rowe, who today is going to be leading our discussion on our monthly war report. It is the last Monday of the month, and so we are going to be bringing you all of the developments from the past month, or actually more accurately, the past couple days in the war report, the war going on around the world, the developments happening with Syria and Turkey, all around Libya and Egypt. We've had a big election with results recently announced in Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood took control of the nation's current political affairs. And what are we specifically going to be talking about
today?
Well,
we've been following the increased violence in Syria since last summer. We've been covering it. And it recently ratcheted up quite a bit. And the incident was that the Syrians shot down a Turkish military plane a couple of days ago. And it was a Turkish F-4. And there's some apparently it was in international waters, the Turks claim at the time. But it had violated Turkish airspace. And in any event, I'd like to ask Marshawn, what is the significance of the shooting down of this plane? What does it tell us about the looming surrogate confrontations going on between the United States and Russia in Syria?
Well, I think it is a massive escalation in tensions between NATO, the U.S. obviously included, our Arab allies, and Russia, Syria, Iran, and China. What's interesting is it was about a week ago, there was a report in Debka, the Israeli intelligence agency, that Russia was shipping in to Syria its anti-aircraft and anti-ship surface-to-air missile systems, along with military advisors to teach the Syrians how to operate these. Well, apparently this Turkish jet, the Phantom 2, F-4 Phantom 2, which is a kind of iconic, we see it as the iconic Vietnam War fighter jet, but it actually, this is an updated, upgraded, modern version of that old fighter. So it's got some of the latest and greatest military technology on it, actually also equipped with Israeli-made countermeasures. And it appears it was brought down by a Russian Pantsir-1 surface-to-air missile system. Now, most likely, the reason why this is very significant is this isn't just a group of amateur Syrians shooting down a Turkish jet. More likely than not, they weren't even Syrians manning the things, because it takes more than a week to learn how to fire a very complex surface-to-air missile system. According to Debka, the Israeli intelligence agency, and various other sources I've read, including Russia Today and Haaretz, it's very apparent that it was Russian ground crews, Russian soldiers who brought down the Turkish jet.
And we have to point out that Russia has had a very close relationship with Syria for many years now. In fact, they have a mutual defense treaty, no?
Yes. Well, Russia has a mutual defense treaty with Iran. Iran has a mutual defense treaty with Syria.
Okay, so what we're essentially seeing in this unrest that's being promoted by the United States is an attempt to overthrow a key Russian ally in the region, and also to make more vulnerable the Iranians. So as we look at this not just as a question of domestic unrest, but as a sort of almost like the Spain in the 1930s, a huge power confrontation between great powers taking place in Syria. And it seemed to me, and we talked about this before, that the American strategy here is to take out Syria. And maybe there's an understanding with the Israelis. We will take out Syria before the Israelis attack Iran, probably after the November American election. That's what seems like is going on.
Well, and I think to a great extent, that is absolutely true. And I think to add another dimension to it, the Russians know that if Syria falls, they will be faced with the exact same – they will be faced with the exact same dilemma we're faced with if Syria – If Syria falls, we will have a full spectrum dominance over most of the Middle East. And in fact, we will be able to circle in Iran and possibly drive the Russians and the Chinese completely out of the Middle East. On the other hand, if the Russians manage to hold on, then we could potentially be driven into the sea. If we're driven out of Syria, then it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to push the U.S. out of Israel and out of the Gulf Arab nations and give Russia dominance over the Middle East. And in fact, Putin said in his own political manifesto that oil. He who controls the world's oil will have controls the world. And so by extension, the Russians have to know that if they lose Syria, it's over. So this is the great game. This is the great game that was fought in the very early 19th century into the 20th century for control over the Middle Eastern oil and Central Asian routes. So I definitely think that there's a lot more at stake here than just the fate of a few Syrian protesters.
So the F-4 that was shot down, the Turkish plane, was not an antique. It was actually, although it's an old plane, it was actually a very well-equipped modern plane. How does it compare to the planes that we were shipping, lots of planes to the Gulf region, the F-22s, the F-16s?
F-22s and F-16s. The only difference is that this has been combat tested, and it has failed the combat test. The F-22 has never been flown in combat. Likewise, the F-16 has been flown in combat, but they've all fought against old, antique, Cold War era technology.
It was like World War II and aircraft.
Oh, they were firing at the American Air Force with flat cannons. I mean, it was an absurdity to think that this was a trial by fire for our brave pilots. Rather, I mean, they were shooting. The equivalent is I'm in a tank, you have a turn-of-the-century musket. You know, it's not a contest. But on the other hand, you look at Syria, and especially if these are being manned by Russians, especially because the Russians have learned from – they've learned our tactics. When the Israelis went in and bombed Syria's nuclear facility back in the mid to – you know, I guess we're talking probably four or five years ago, the Russians learned, oh, so they have a means of jamming our surface-to-air missile systems. So they upgraded from the Pantsir S-1 to the Pantsir 1.
Okay, so the Russians upgraded in response to the Israeli attack on Syria, and Syria did not respond, which kind of mystified me, to that attack when the Israelis bombed them. But this time, obviously, it's a different show. And the Russians are. Do the Russians feel now that they could handle, say, a Libyan style air attack?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, they've spent the better part of the last 10, 15 years preparing for a Western style war. They've been building up their military. They've been improving their technology. They've been watching our tactics. So they learned a lot from our 2003 invasion of Iraq. They learned a lot from our Libya intervention. And they've been preparing themselves to stand against us. And that's really, really, when you get down to it, what this shooting down of this Turkish jet was about. It was about the Russians saying, this is not – I've heard people compare this to the Gulf of Tonkin. But the fact is that the Gulf of Tonkin was nothing like this because, well, first of all, you know, believe it or not, the Gulf of Tonkin was fabricated. But this wasn't fabricated. The Syrians and the Russians shot down this jet. Why? Because they're pushing back. We're pushing them. We're sending guns to Wahhabi, Al-Qaeda-funded
militants. We were daring them to fire at one of the NATO member ships by flying into their airspace. And at first, Turkey said, we weren't anywhere near their airspace. It was international waters. And then when it was downed and discovered, it was within Syrian waters.
And now they're kind of claiming, well, it was only in Syrian airspace for a little bit. And
right.
This was an accident, you know. Which I think you're absolutely right. We were pushing them. We were violating their airspace. Turkey was, at least, mm-hmm. you know,
on behalf of NATO, though. Let's be realistic.
Yeah, let's talk about the role of Turkey here. It's just not a random shooting. Now Turkey has been the staging area for the infiltration of really terrorists.
Can you hear yourself now?
Yes, thank you.
All right.
Can you move a little closer to the mic?
It's been the staging area for the infiltration of Syria with terrorists. And we know from reports in Debka, the important Israeli intelligence ladder, that the Qatar and Saudi Arabia are financing the importation of these terrorists and weapons. It was even reported recently in the New York Times that we have CIA agents stationed in Turkey there to manage the flow of armaments to these people who are trying to overthrow Assad. And again, as we've said many times in the show, that this isn't really about some kind of democratic uprising. The American people are being misled. This is part of the campaign for global military hegemony by the United States that started really in 1991 with the first attack on Iraq. And as we've mentioned before, also, it's been recounted by General Wesley Clark, who years ago said on television, and you can watch it on YouTube, just put in General Wesley Clark, Iraq and it'll come up. It's about a 2-minute clip on TV where he talks about seeing a memorandum in the Pentagon, came out of the Secretary of Defense office. He saw this a few weeks after 9/11, and that memo said it's going to be the U.S. policy to overthrow 7 Middle Eastern countries, and included Libya, it included Iraq, it included Somalia, Sudan, Lebanon, Syria, and he said it was culminating with Iran. And that's, of course, the great prize. So we're near the end of this, in a way.
Even looking at it from a just sheerly common sense perspective, even if we didn't have the generals or anyone saying this, it's just absolute common sense. Iran and Syria are Russian and Chinese allies. Israel, the Emirates, and Turkey are American allies. If we knock off Syria and Iran, we control the Middle East. We hem in Russia. We control the world's oil, natural gas supply, and all of the trade routes through the Gulf of Aden and through the Suez Canal. I mean, it's common sense. It's also in keeping with the Oded Inyon plan. Israel wants a greater state of Israel that's going to expand from everything east of the Nile to everything west of the Euphrates. So there are a lot of forces at work here that really don't want to see – that really want to see Syria fall, that want to see Iran fall. But on the other side, there are the Russians and the Chinese who've decided, hey, you know, the Americans are downsizing their military. The Americans are not investing in modernizing their armed forces. The Americans are investing in drones and special forces. We have one soldier for every American citizen. This is ridiculous. Why should we be afraid of them?
Well, you know, you mentioned the Oded Inyon plan, and let's talk about that for just a second, because General Wesley Clark's speech is very dramatic in showing what our policy has been for the last decade. But there is a paper trail for this policy, which goes back very far. In the Oded Inyon plan, 1982, is something that people should be aware of. Probably nobody's ever going to mention it on network news. The fellow's name was Oded, O-D-E-D, Inyon, Y-I-N-O-N. In 1982, he published a scholarly article outlining what was then the present Israeli regime, long-term strategy for the Middle East. And it was based on a division of all of the countries in the area into small states, breaking down their central governments and turning them into small, really unmanageable fiefdoms, kind of like what we've done in Yugoslavia.
Yugoslavia, I think, is the prime example.
And in fact, as Rick Rosoff pointed out in a recent article, Rick Rosoff is a global strategist we've had on our show several times.
Right, yep.
He pointed out that one of the key Syrian leaders of the supposed Syrian liberation movement, who actually worked for the Brookings Institution in Washington, lives here. He was sent a few months ago to Kosovo. Okay, the breakaway Yugoslav Republic, to study the Kosovo Liberation Army's tactics against the central government there, and as to bring people back. You know, we bombed the heck out of Yugoslavia in '99 to break up that country, and the KLA, which were characterized as freedom fighters in our press, this Kosovo army was in fact a bunch of drug dealers, they're drug smugglers, and they were doing things like murdering Serbs to harvest their body parts. Mm-hmm. But it certainly didn't play out that way in the time.
It's the kind of characters you want to associate with.
Oh, yeah. This is great.
I mean, after all, we are funding al-Qaeda militants in Libya and Syria. I mean, I find that so hypocritical to begin with. The very notion that, oh, well, we got to go into Afghanistan. We got to fight al-Qaeda. We got to fight al-Qaeda in Yemen. Al-Qaeda. Oh, we got to feel up your underwear every time you go on a plane because al-Qaeda wants to blow us up. But, I mean, a 2-year-old could put this together. We're giving guns and money to al-Qaeda in Syria and Libya, but we're fighting them?
But it's not just specifically al-Qaeda. It's crazy people all over the world.
Well, that's true, too.
It's the Contras. It's the Nicaraguan drug cartels.
Right.
You know, it's the Ecuadorian drug lords. It's like everywhere in the world, most unsavory, disgusting, despicable characters, they're our best friends.
Nicaragua is another good analogy.
Yeah,
we
train
these Contras and we're financing them with drug money.
Right. And what's the phrase? You judge a tree by its fruit and a company that a person keeps. So if someone let's say that you just met someone and you're dating for the first couple times and you meet their friends and they've all got like scars on their faces and they're like shady, standing in the corner with trench coats, you know, and they're like making backroom deals with people, like, you know, this guy keeps some pretty unsavory company. Maybe I should move on. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is our government.
Well, and, you know, like I say, there's the sheer absurdity. I mean, because like you're saying, it's so self-evident. These people are not nice people, but we're funding them. But the fact is, why are we funding them? Why do we fund the Contras in Nicaragua? Why are we funding Al-Qaeda-related militants in Syria and Libya? Because we're fighting a war with the Russians. The problem is unlike the Cold War, the Russians know mutually assured destruction, no longer so mutually assured. Mm-hmm. The Russians have surpassed us militarily in so many ways. And folks, you know, this isn't just me babbling or fear-mongering, you know, watch out for the Red Menace. Go and look up these Russian weapon systems, the Pantsir 1, the S-300, the S-400, the T-90 battle tank. I mean, if you read what these vehicles are capable of, it's mind-boggling, and they've all been battle-tested. I mean, they've all seen combat in places like Chechnya against well-armed and well-equipped American-funded Al-Qaeda insurgents in Chechnya.
And the realism is that right here, we're trying to tell people that we want to avoid a world war. We do not want to get involved. We're unconstitutionally involved in these foreign conflicts. We do not have the right or the authority in our government to unilaterally decide who becomes leader, who is president, what kind of government they are to have. But the mainstream media is not telling people the realistic concern or the cost of what this is going to end up adding up to. I only heard one time on Friday when this jet was shot down. It was the radio station 101.9. It's a commercial news station. And they said a fighter jet owned by Turkey was shot down in Syrian airspace. Could this be the lead up to World War III as Syria and Iran have defense treaties with China and Russia? And this was like a 10-second headline clip. And I was thinking this should be like flashed in red all over the place. This is what's really important.
This is,
and they, you know, they said it, but then they moved on to talk about sports.
Let me just remind the audience, you're listening to In Context, a live public affairs call-in show on WPKN 89.5 FM. My name is Ken McDermott. I'm here with my fellow host Gus Contivero and with our military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott, and we're talking about the escalating violence in the Mideast and its broader implications for us here at home.
If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us your comments at ken@mdrtalk.org, and we will relay your comments on the air. That's ken@mdrtalk.org.
And we'll give out the phone number shortly.
And I think, you know, people always say, you know, oh, this sort of thing never happens. You know, superpowers have much more common sense. But my favorite example, I've been doing a lot of research on the First World War because I see immense amount of parallels. And in the lead up to World War I, there was tensions between Austro-Hungary and Serbia. The Serbs, you know, wanted land. The Austro-Hungarians wanted Serbia. Well, the Archduke of Austro-Hungary, plugged in Sarajevo, killed by a Serbian nationalist. So what happens then? Austro-Hungary invades Serbia. Well, Serbia had a defense treaty with Russia. The Russians had to go defend their Slav brethren, so Russia declares war on Austro-Hungary. Germany is in alliance with Austro-Hungary. Germany declares war on Russia. France is in alliance with Russia. France has to now declare war on Germany and Austro-Hungary. And Britain has an alliance with the French and the Russians, so Britain has drawn into the war. And then Turkey kind of voluntarily came into the war later on. The whole point that I'm trying to make with this is that the premise behind preventing the First World War in the first place was that these super blocs, the Allies on one side with the French, the Russians, and the Brits against the Central Powers, the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians, they would have such immense armies, they're of such immense size, with such brutal weaponry that there could never be a war. But the problem is, it was all a load of malarkey, because these interconnecting alliances led to war. And as Rowan Atkins had famously said, it became too much trouble not to have a war. And I think that's one thing we're seeing now, is we're pushing the Russians. They're pushing back because they realize we're not, you know, we're a paper tiger now. So they're pushing back. We're pushing back. And unless somebody gets some common sense and backs down, it'll hurtle into another world war, the same as it always has.
But isn't it interesting what common knowledge is about the wars, though? I mean, World War II, you ask anybody, what was World War II about? And they're like, well, Germany wanted elbow room, right? And then World War I, nobody really knows. They're just
World War II was a continuation of World War I. It was a European civil war between the British Empire and the rising German Empire. And the analogy to continue is that now the present war is between the American Empire and the rising, resurgent Russian Empire and the rising Chinese Empire.
I think like even pseudo intellectuals, you know, who like to think that they know something, if they would say World War One, well, you know, that was the war to end all wars, right? That was going to bring world peace. And when you dig below the surface, though, that logic doesn't really hold up. Like, what was the provocation for the war? What Like, why? Well, why did everyone get drawn into it?
Well, because as Paul Kennedy writes in his brilliant book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, every great power starts spending a lot of its, at its zenith, spends a lot of its wealth on the military to prevent any challenger from coming along. And for Britain in the late 1800s, it saw its industrial base being surpassed by the Germans. And the Germans said, hey, you, Britain covers one third of the globe. We have, what do we have, a sausage factory in Africa?
Oh, yeah, that was Roan Atkinson famously said that. Roan Atkinson famously said, you know, they said the British Empire at present covers a quarter of the globe, while the German Empire consists of a small sausage factory in Tanganyika. You know, I think we can hardly be held blameless on the imperialistic front. And, Hugh Laurie says, oh, no, absolutely not, sir. Matt is a bicycle. But he does actually this great dissection of, you know, the causes for the First World War. And, you know, one thing you see right off the bat is, you know, the interconnecting alliances, but also, everybody, you know, massive armies, everybody saw an opportunity. The British Empire was overstretched. Their colonies, Germany thought, well, Germany and Austro-Hungary felt, well, we can split Britain from its colonies. You know, the Russians can't mobilize enough forces. That was the von Schlieffen plan for the invasion of France. The Germans said, well, the Russians won't be able to mobilize enough troops, you know, quickly enough. We were, during the Franco-Prussian War, we were in Paris in 6 weeks. By the time the Russians mobilize, it'll take them 3 months. We can take Paris and turn our armies around and face the Russians.
But the initial domino effect was all these mutual defense treaties.
Absolutely. Yeah. And overconfidence. That's a problem that we have right now.
Sound
in
familiar?
The United States. Exactly. We think, oh, well,
be over in weeks, right?
It'll be over in weeks. We will bomb Syria into oblivion the same way we bombed Libya and Iraq into oblivion. We will intimidate the Russians.
We'll be home by Labor Day.
Yeah, we'll be home by Labor Day. Yeah.
And the reason why we're sort of scaring the audience, I think they should be scared about the events.
I'm scared.
I'm frightened.
It's not because we want to wave the bloody shirt. We don't want to see increased military spending and we need more and better planes. Quite the opposite. It's been our consistent position in this and in context that we need a new foreign policy. We need to stop trying to dictate to the rest of the world what governments they should have. Our foreign policy shouldn't be run for the benefit of large multinational corporations. It should be run for the benefit of you and me, which means good relationships with other countries, not trying to take them over.
And also, people need to be aware. I mean, you know, I say this again, you know, like you point out, this is why we got to take on the Reds and stuff. No, what should we do? Well, it's pretty obvious. The Russians want to have the Middle East. Let them. We have oil. We have natural gas here. You know, we can find alternative fuels. We have one of the greatest countries on the planet with some of the best innovations and most innovative minds in the world. Why do we have to come to blows with the Russians, you know, because we should control the Middle East? It doesn't make any sense. And people need to think about, are you willing to sacrifice your life? Are you willing to send your son or daughter to die so that we can have full spectrum dominance over the Middle East so we can kick the Russians out of the Middle
East? But that's just people's individual arrogance that is being served there, because empire doesn't work.
No.
It clearly doesn't work. It doesn't help rise all the standard of living around the world. It does, for a period of time, give the dominating nation cheaper products. But after a while, you start to see that cost catches up to you, because you now have to pay the bill for those cheaper products, so to speak. And that's what we're doing right now. We're paying the bill for all of our empire around the world. And we can't afford the interest payments.
We're putting it on the tab now, and we're only able to sustain ourselves with this manipulation of interest rates down to zero.
Which is eventually going to collapse our own currency.
That's right.
And it always invariably leads to a confrontation with the rising empires. I mean, you know, the British Empire clashing with the French Empire, you know, the Napoleonic Wars. I mean, you know, France was the up-and-coming empire. Britain was the old world empire, well, relatively at the time, old empire. So it was inevitable that if Britain didn't back down, they would come into conflict with the French, who wanted a piece of the action. World War I, same difference. World War II, the Germans and the Japanese decided, the Japanese especially said, you know, if the Westerners can be at the imperialism game in Asia, why can't we? Just because we're yellow, we can't be at the imperialism game, was their rationale. So they decided they wanted a piece of the action. And because the Brits and the Americans and the Allies decided we didn't want to give them a piece of the action, you had World War II. Now it's happening all over again. History is repeating itself.
And this time it's the
Russians,
US.
The Russians and the Chinese want a piece of the action. The US and NATO control, you know, large swaths of the Middle East, Western and Eastern Europe, and the Russians and the Chinese say we want a piece of the action. So instead of cutting them a piece of the action, we say, nah, You're not getting anything.
You know, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, 1990, we immediately adopted this new foreign policy of no longer containment of the Soviet Union, but the drive for military hegemony. And the opening act of that was George Bush Sr. and our attack on Iraq over Kuwait.
Probably because they no longer saw that the aggressive communist military stance was going to rush to oppose them. So they said,
right,
we finally have a window of opportunity where we can stretch military dominance and not risk, you know, the Reds coming out to engage us in direct combat. The Cold War is over. We won. And
that's right. Until Putin came along, Russia was pretty a weak.
And Putin, you know, there's a great documentary I would definitely recommend called The Putin System. It's on YouTube. It was had many, many interviews with people from Putin's childhood, from people who've worked with him, and from biographers who've written about him, and historians. And one of the things you got to realize about this guy is he's an imperialist. He wants to restore the glory, if you will, of the Soviet Union with the empire of the czars. And, you know, the history, again, I keep saying it, there's nothing new in history. Russia has always wanted to be an empire. They've always been an empire. They clashed with the Brits. You had the Crimean War. You had, you know, the conflicts with the Brits in Iran, a little known aspect, but part of the great game, the struggle for Central Asia. The Brits, the Iranians fought against the Russians who were trying to invade Iran in the 19th century.
I'm wondering if we could become the first Western empire to renounce empire before we get, you know, or get kicked down.
Well, I think that's a moral of what we're trying to tell the
American
people.
We need to renounce. We need to let go of it. The way, say, the white regime in South Africa let go of apartheid.
Right.
We need to walk away from it before it brings huge disaster to our country.
I think that's a moral of what we're trying to tell the American people, because obviously our leaders are determined to set us on a collision course, which invariably, if it turns out to be a world war, again, mutually assured destruction isn't so mutually assured anymore. They can pummel us. And if it gets bad, I mean, they could really, best case scenario, in the event of a world war, we just slog it out and bleed each other dry in the Middle East. Worst case scenario, we get bombed at home. They have the capability of doing that. And so the moral of what we're trying to do is, let's be that Western power to renounce the empire, to come back, say, you know what, let's protect the homeland. Let's build our defenses at home. Let's focus our economy.
Let's be realistic. How many times in history have peaceful countries been attacked?
Switzerland?
Never. I mean, how long has Switzerland been a democracy? It's like 750 years or something.
And in Switzerland, they have an entire policy of national defense. Everybody serves in the military. Everybody takes their weapon home that they served with. Everybody owns multiple guns because they have multiple generations. And at the end of the day, nobody invades Switzerland. Why? Not because they have a strong national defense, but because they have a strong national defense and they want no part of the empire.
Which kind of brings us back to the war on terror, is that people have to be made scared, because, as Gus said, we really don't have much to be frightened about. And we're a very strong country, very rich country with oceans on either side of us. So the war on terror was really cooked up and it's kept fed every year in order to keep us scared, keep us behind this war policy.
Well, that's the ironic thing. That's what I find kind of funny to look at, is people will get, you know, frightened of, oh my gosh, you know, Omar Abdulmutallab, you know, he's put a bomb, Al-Qaeda's putting bombs in their underwear and trying to blow up airplanes. Meanwhile, the Russians and the Chinese have submarines that go up our coast. They have the capability of flying bombers and jets and hitting us on our homeland. They could field one soldier for every living American citizen. They could, if they wanted to, flatten the continental United States. They have EMP bombs that could wipe out our entire electrical grid and null our ability to launch nukes. Our ability to launch nukes. They have all this. But somehow, to be frightened of that very real threat is unreasonable. But to be frightened of some guy with a bomb in his pants is a reasonable, credible threat.
So you make people take their shoes off when they get on an airplane, because that's a constant reminder that they should be afraid.
Exactly.
Right? It may be an illusory fear, but it works.
Instead of saying, listen, folks, you know, do we want to get pummeled by the Russians and the Chinese? Do we want our young men and women, not just the ones in uniform, but do we want a draft where our young best and brightest, our youth are going to go get slaughtered on some front line? Or do we want to pull back, defend the homeland, have a policy of neutrality? It's worked well for Ireland. It's worked well for Switzerland.
It worked well for the United States from the time of George Washington right up until 1898, when we just got this addiction to empire.
Well, I would go back to the Mexican-American War.
Okay, yeah, well, yeah, that was pretty nasty. And General Grant, who fought in that, thought it was about the most unjustified worried.
Abraham Lincoln said it was famously said. Yeah, young congressman. He was a congressman, right?
That's from right.
Illinois famously said that it was the most unjustifiable war in human history.
Yeah, Lincoln was against. These are guys we need to look back on. You know, these people who were Republican or Democrats, they wrap themselves in the American flag and they talk about how we need to be abroad in Iran and crush this axis of evil. They forget about these guys. We need to go back to guys like Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, policy, avoid entangling alliances. Thomas Jefferson, who worked very hard during his administration to keep us out of the Napoleonic Wars. These are the guys we need. And what do? We built a great country. We built a very prosperous country by staying out of foreign wars.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's another thing, too. One of the things I also find really interesting to look at is people always wonder, well, why are the politicians, you know, why is President Obama so eager to go to war? Well, his children aren't going to die on the front lines. Yours are. You know, but I think that's something people need to wake up to. Our politicians don't feel they have a stake in this anymore. They don't feel that they have a stake in the war because, you know, if we win, they get rich and powerful. If, you know, a million young Americans die, well, it's not their children, so why should they care?
How do you think this Syrian war – actually, can we give out our phone number now?
Is that sure. Yeah.
Okay. Let's do that. It's if you'd like to join our conversation, you're listening to In Context, WPKN 89.5 FM. It's a live public affairs call-in show. We're talking today about the increased violence in the Middle East, and you can give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756 to give us your thoughts, your questions on the rising violence of in the Mideast and the whole outlook for having a new American foreign policy, how you feel about that. Or you could drop us an email to ken@mdrtalk.org if you'd rather do that.
And we actually have a caller. Oop. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air with WPKN. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Thank you. This is Mark in Deer Park, Long Island.
Okay, and what's your comment?
Hi, Mark.
How you doing, guys? You know, you were talking about how Switzerland, everybody's armed, everybody keeps the peace themselves. You know, Israel does the same thing. And us as Americans are friends of Israel. And you've been talking all this time about how the Middle East and that we should just give it up to the Russians. But if we do that, then Israel becomes lost and alone by itself. How do we resolve that from happening?
Is that our responsibility?
Yeah. What do you see our responsibility as vis-a-vis Israel?
Well, if you're not already familiar, that most of the retired Israeli Mossad agents come here to America and train us Americans.
So then we need to save Israel so they can train us?
Well, no. What do you think? Yeah. What do you think, though, are the American interest is in Israel? Go ahead, Marshawn.
No, go. Ask your question, and I'll make my
comment. Yeah, Mark, I mean, what do you tell the American people about, you know, what is our interest in Israel? How far should we go if Israel, you know, to defend the state of Israel?
I think we should go to the nth degree. I mean, Israel is mostly a lot of Americans that have gone over to Israel, the Jewish population mostly, gone over to Israel to make, you know, become home their homeland, so to speak, and... You know, with everything that's been going on right now in the Middle East, Israel has nobody else to help defend it except themselves. And look what we did to ourselves. You know, back in the early 50s and 60s, you know, we were required to serve our military. Why did that stop? You know, Israel still does it today. You come out of high school, you go right into the military. And I think
it's a small country.
We did the same thing.
Marshawn, did you want to ask Mark a question? Or?
Well, I mean, I think I can understand what you're saying, where you're coming from. I mean, you know, we have to look after our allies, but there has to be a point. I mean, wouldn't you say where we look at our own national interests first? I mean, no country should ever put its own domestic policy, or ever really does put its own domestic policy, the good of its own nation, behind that of an ally. I mean, your allies are important to you. But when they are asking you to sacrifice what should be, you know, what should only be in it for the sake of the existence of your own country, I mean, at what point should we be willing to sacrifice young American lives for somebody else's flag or somebody else's cause? I mean,
you got to understand, it's not just the retired Mossad. A lot of intelligence through our CIA comes from Israel in that Middle Eastern area. And we're getting a lot of intel.
Wait a minute. That means it comes through the filter of Israeli ears for our consumption, meaning that they manipulate it to always favor their opinion. Do you ever think that that information coming from Israel is going to paint Israel into a corner to make them look bad?
No, but they're not the bully here.
Well, Israel is definitely doing whatever it is that they feel they need to do, regardless of what kind of position it puts us in. And I don't think that you can continue to support someone ad infinitum forever, indefinitely, no matter what the cost, if they don't ever seem to make the situation any easier. Meaning, I don't think we can write a blank check on this. At some point, you're going to have to put a limit on it.
I guess the question, you know, Marchand raised is, you know, would you tell somebody that their son should die in Syria or Israel or Jordan or whatever, fighting to defend Israel? And I frankly, Mark, I would say no. I would not tell some mother her son should die for that. Not that I wish anything ill to happen to the Israelis, but I'm not prepared to send her son to die
for that.
There's a point.
When every nation has to choose its own destiny. And if the Israelis decide, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, it's their land, it's their country, let them fight for it.
They do every day. I mean, they've given us a lot of military, not just intelligence, but also equipment. You know, you look at certain products these days and you turn it over and it says made in Israel.
Does that justify sacrificing? I mean, when you think about it, look at these military funerals, and you know, I've seen a few, and I have to say, I mean, it's heart-wrenching. It is absolutely heart-wrenching. If you can imagine thousands of those because we get dragged into a conflict for the sake of Israel. I mean, I would sacrifice my life for the sake of the United States, for the sake of our homeland, but would I want to see my friends, would I want my own children to sacrifice their lives for somebody else's flag and somebody else's homeland? I mean, I think that's, I'm not knocking you. I'm saying that that's, I think, the question that we need to look at.
Yeah, I'm really glad you raised this.
I think you raised a very good
point. You really raised a good point,
and
Mark.
I'm afraid we have to leave it at that because we have another caller,
thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Go ahead, caller. You're on the air with WPKN. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Rudy from New Haven.
Hi, Rudy.
Just fascinated by your talk today, and I would just like to add that it's insane when you think of it, a nation of 300 million people so steeped in a democratic past are beholden to this little country of 6 million. I mean, in terms of our defense, in terms of the future of our children, blah, blah, blah. And it would also seem crazy and somewhat self-destructive that these 6 million people would be so beholden to us.
That's true.
It makes no sense. It makes no sense for our future. If you have kids like you guys are talking about, I can't understand why it's happening.
How do you think you would go about defusing the situation? Is it the U.S. responsibility to try to defuse the situation in the Middle East between Israel and its neighbors?
Or should we just
disengage and let these guys work it out on their own?
If we disengage, clearly they're just going to all kill each other. I mean, Israel will not exist in 10 years.
Well, let me ask you a question. Israel has, 800 nuclear warheads?
Oh. And where are they all pointed? That's the other thing.
Well, no, I don't know.
If I were in Berlin, Munich, Kiev, etc., I'd be nervous. I'd want to know where those 800 missiles are pointed.
Because they're not all pointed...
at Tehran. They're not all pointed at, probably none are at Damascus, because Damascus is too close to Israel.
Right, right.
So where are they pointed? That's a very good question, and we have the right to know, because we pay for them.
That's a good point.
My point being is that Israel is very capable of taking care of itself militarily. It is very well stocked, very well trained, very well funded.
And that's my point also, right. Is they will choose global Armageddon rather than sacrifice their theocratic racist state. That is a very viable question that the whole world should be asking.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks, Rudy.
I think the main point here is that Israel is capable of taking care of itself. I think if we disengage, I disagree with the caller saying that Israel will not exist in 10 years. That is, you know, just the opinion. I do not like to predict the future. Except for in cases of mathematical certainties, where such as vis-a-vis our economy or unwinnable conflicts. But I think Israel's citizenry And this is well documented through Haaretz and other sources. The Israel citizenry are very against any more wars, and that they want to live in peace with the Palestinians and with the Iranians.
And in all honesty, I mean, I think if the United States said to the Israeli government, said to Benjamin Netanyahu, listen, you know, we're done. We're not going to – we'll help you economically. We'll help you with, you know – increase like
crop weapons
holes
or
and stuff, you know. Yeah, we'll give you peaceful tools, and we will even help broker a peace with the Palestinians. But we're not going to engage in. We're not going to help you in a war.
I think
if we told that to the Israelis, look, if you go to war, you're on your own. I think the Israeli leadership would very rapidly decide.
Well, wait, let's talk about this.
Let's talk to the Iranians.
Let's go back to the Camp David Accords with Jimmy Carter. Negotiated back in 1979, which made peace between Egypt and Israel, but at the price of something like $3 billion a year to Israel. We bought them off.
You can't bribe people into peace.
Why don't we say to Israel or in Egypt, no more money, that's it. You say, Israel, you've got to close down those West Bank settlements that are really, I think, huge roadblock to permanent settlement. In Palestine, and you just close them or no more money. That's it. But I don't think I think both Mark and Rudy were made excellent contributions here by pointing out the key role that our relationship with Israel mm-hmm. is playing in this whole.
And I think that if you stop supporting Israel and saying that no matter what happens, we will back you up militarily, I think all of a sudden people become a little less arrogant. When you take away the threat of a gun, all of a sudden the arrogance goes away, and now all of a sudden you have to really negotiate for the betterment of your populace, you know? And I think that a one-state solution where everyone gets one man, one vote, and a citizenry of the greater state of whatever you want to call it, Israel, Palestine, whatever, or even if it's just a nation state of some type where they haven't adhered agenda.
Yeah, I think that was something that should be on the table.
It really should be discussed seriously.
Particularly from the American perspective, where we have a pluralistic democracy, if we want to share our values, that would be a solution.
Exactly, because I think what values. We should be exporting is not arms, and what we should be exporting is not, you know, war. What we got to export is peace and diplomacy, because the fact is, at the end of the day, you know, I spent a lot of time in Egypt, and, you know, I want to say just, you know, The Egyptians and the Arabs as a whole are some of the most hospitable, wonderful people I've ever met. I mean, you'd be embarrassed by their hospitality, even though they have nothing. You know, people won't come out and help their neighbor in a flood, but in Egypt, people will offer you food when they live in a mud hut.
Forget a flood. People will just walk over someone who's been hit by a car here in the United States.
Exactly. So, I mean, these are very wonderful, admirable people. But when, you know, they really resent the Americans, instead of viewing us as friends and allies, they resent us. Why? 6 Egyptian police officers were killed not that long ago by Israeli jets who were bombing terrorist tunnels along the border. And I put air quotes, obviously. You can't see that on the radio, but air quotes. Terrorist tunnels. You know, I realize my gestures aren't as effective on the radio, but anyway. Where was I going with this? Yes. But the Egyptians look around, they say, wait a minute, those are American-supplied jets, those are American-supplied bombs, and they're killing our people. And moreover, we deny the Egyptians dignity by saying, no, you can't have troops in Sinai. You can't. Now, the Israelis can bomb you on the Sinai, but you can't have troops on the Sinai. And then we tell the Palestinians, well, listen, you know, you guys got to stop shooting rockets. The Israelis can pound you from the air, but you got to stop shooting rockets. And so what does that do? That causes people to resent us. We wonder why people hate us. And where does it turn them to? It turns them to the Russian camp. It turns them to the Chinese camp, because the Russians say, look, we don't care what kind of government you have. Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan Muslimin, you know, Islamist state in Iran, or a secular government in Syria. We don't care. Just, you know, help follow our...
If you just joined us, I just want to remind the audience, you're listening to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. If you'd like to join our conversation, we've been talking about the escalation of the violence in the Middle East, starting with the recent downing by Syria, the Turkish military plane. Give us a ring at 203-336-9756. We're only going to be on for about another 10 minutes, so give us a ring in these last few minutes at 203-336-9756 and tell us what you think.
So, and what you're saying is that we're basically driving other countries into the arms of the Russians and the Chinese.
That's the moral.
We're literally creating an opposition force that is completely undefeatable.
Exactly, because they have the power of Russia and China behind them. Instead of making friends in the Middle East so that we can, I mean, protecting things like our oil supply, protecting things like our natural gas supply, our trade routes.
Well, Iran is a good example. After World War II, they developed a democratic government under Mossadegh. And in 1953, we overthrew him. And it's been downhill for ever since.
Absolutely.
What we've basically been doing is the equivalent of on the playground when you're picking kickball teams. You pick one ally is Israel. I'm going to take Israel. And then Russia picks an ally. And then we just start insulting everybody else in line until they all join the other team.
Exactly.
And we have another call.
We have a caller. Oh, go ahead, caller. You're on the air with WPKN. What's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Adam Fisher, and I'm calling from Stony Brook.
We don't need last names, but that's okay.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for calling.
Is this on the air? Or are you just
you're on the air.
You're on the air.
Yeah,
okay.
You're on the air.
I've been listening to the conversation, and frankly, it's hard for me to believe what I'm listening to. It's a kind of Israel bashing that just is incredible to me. The fundamental reality historically. Is that Jordan is Palestine. That's number one. Number two, the central view of the Arab world has always been and continued to be, including Arafat's rejection of the peace treaty, was that Israel is a sword in their side and has no business being there. That's the second point. And everything else after that is just blather.
Adam, you know, we weren't saying who is right or wrong in this dispute. What we're saying is specifically, I would not send I'd not tell an American mother that her son should go and die for Israel.
Nobody suggested that.
That's kind of the moral of what we're trying to get to, because when we look at this conflict emerging over Syria and over Iran, a lot of it is because, I mean, the Israelis are frightened. There is a conflict there. But the biggest problem is that we're, to an extent, at the behest of the Israelis and in conjunction with them, dragging ourselves into a war in the Middle East right now, which is dragging in also the Russians and the Chinese. I mean, the Russians shooting down his Turkish jet.
We never even mentioned Israel in the entire program today until the first caller mentioned Israel.
And that kind of came in tangentially.
And so we actually go out of our way to sort of avoid, you know, blaming Israel for anything.
Yeah, what we've been doing, Adam, is since last summer, we've been tracking the increase in violence in Syria. We've been documenting, actually been documented through Israelis' intelligence newsletter, DEPCA, the increased involvement of the U.S. and NATO in fomenting this violence and creating a civil war in Syria to overthrow the Syrian government as part of the American military expansion. That's what we've been focusing on, and we are very concerned that this is going to turn into a big, major power war between Russia, possibly China on one side, and the United States and our Arab allies on the other side. That's our real focus here.
That's a whole different kind of question. But to my knowledge,
that's the program.
Israel has never asked an American soldier to fight for them.
Well, as we watch the development of the situation in Syria, it appears that the strategy now is to take out Syria before the November election so that Israel can go ahead and attack Iran after the election.
And a lot of this is acknowledged through Israeli sources that we're citing.
Right, now,
Peretz and Debka both
right
had
now,
articles on this.
So the next step, it seems to be an air campaign such as went on in Libya. And the significance of the Turkish plane being downed is it appears that this is not going to be a cakewalk like Libya, that the Russian technology technicians, they're all their aid in Syria, they have Marines there, they probably have a lot of special forces there. This is going to be a different war. We're not going to be able to win this war with an air campaign. We may not even have NATO support, in which case we may end up with ground troops there. And once that happens, boy, it's going to be a real mess.
The
whole question of whether we should intervene in Syria is a very complicated one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not really calling about that at all. I was just calling about what apparently was a tangential, issue for you.
I'm glad that you brought it up, Adam and Mark and Rudy all brought it, because the relationship with Israel, although we don't talk about it a lot on the show, is a very important issue in the whole foreign policy, especially as
is our relationship also with our NATO allies as well. I mean, I don't personally believe that we should you know, if the Germans decide to pick a fight with one of the Eastern European powers, I don't think necessarily we should run to the defense of them either. I think always our first priority, whether we're talking Israel, whether we're talking NATO, whether we're talking the other Arab states, our first priority has to be what is in the interest of the United States and of our citizenry, and what's going to keep us safe in the long run, and what's going to make us prosperous in the long run.
Well, and also, what can we do to encourage the kind of world we want to live in? Because after all, everything is interrelated today.
That's right.
Absolutely.
No such thing as a separate. There's no such thing as separate. Isolated nations, unless you want to be North Korea.
Right.
Absolutely right. Thank you. Thank you so much, Fisher.
Thanks for calling. Call, Adam.
So I think that's a very good point, you know, is that we are all interconnected. Mm-hmm. But because we're all interconnected, that also means that, you know, if we pick a fight, our enemies are interconnected too.
Or if we stand up for one person in a conflict, that means that we're ipso facto the enemy of the other person.
Are we standing up? I mean, since 1898, when we started the Spanish-American War, more and more and almost completely today, our foreign policy is controlled by special interests, large multinational corporations. It's mm-hmm. not benefiting the average American. And if you look at countries like Guatemala, we overthrew in 1954, Iran in 1953, these were done at the behest, in the case of Iran, at oil companies, mm-hmm. in the case of Guatemala, the United Fruit Company. Mm-hmm. And this has not been the benefit. This is not the foreign policy the American people want.
No.
It's not good for our country.
No.
We need to take our policy back and say, what's good for the country? What's good for the people?
And you know, we've been talking about Israel, and selling weapons and giving foreign aid to Israel creates a lot of resentment in the Middle East directed at the United States.
And I think that's a lot of what we were trying to hit on is, you know, let's export diplomacy and not bombs. You know, mm-hmm. let's step in with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because whether the Palestinians, wherever their real homeland is fundamentally, it doesn't matter. They live there. And we have no right to evict them from their homeland, as they have no right to evict the Israelis from their homeland. Our role as the superpower should be not to supply one side with guns and bombs that can pummel the other. It should be for us to step in and maybe even work within the United Nations, have peacekeepers sent. Maybe we should be brokering peace deals, not brokering wars.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how we're going to get from there. Jimmy Carter said when he was president, we need a foreign policy that's as good as the American people. But we don't have one. We have one that's good for Exxon, that's good for these other, but for Halliburton and the arms manufacturers. Somehow we got to take this foreign policy back.
War's a racket. Smedley Butler, Medal of Honor winner, said that.
War is business and business is
and
good.
And, of course, Mark Twain saw that very clearly. Gus and Marchand and I are going to be up at Ridgefield Community Center this Wednesday for a play at 7:30, Mark Twain versus the Imperialists, which I wrote. It's about the political writings of Mark Twain between 1900 and 1910. And although most people know of Mark Twain as perhaps our most famous writer, the author of Huckleberry Finn, he was, in his time, the most important opponent of imperialism in America, that period 1900 to 1910, at the dawn of American imperialism with the Spanish-American War and the American-Philippine War that followed. And he raised issues which are still relevant today. So we'll be talking about them after the play. So the play is free, and it's at the Ridgefield Community Center at 7:30 p.m. this Wednesday.
Agree with us, disagree with us, that's fine. You know, come up and talk to us. We're, you know, open-minded individuals, and, you know, nothing better than a good discussion.
Just a couple of the headlines that are going on out there right now that we will be covering in our next broadcast, which will be the week after next.
2 weeks. Yeah.
We are not on the air next week because that's the first Monday of the month, and that's for station business. But some of the stuff going on is that there's going to be the decision on the Obamacare law probably within the next 72
yes.
hours. And that'll be a really big discussion once that ruling comes out, and we can read the judge's opinions. And then there's also the Supreme Court has said that the state of Arizona is allowed to uphold their immigration law to be able to check for immigration status.
In routine stops,
right. And also, we didn't even get to talk about the Egyptian election. Is there anything you wanted to mention quickly?
Well, I mean, we only have about 30 seconds, but
give an opinion.
I think the Muslim Brotherhood election is probably the first independent election that Egyptians have had. And people say, well, why would they choose an Islamist organization? Because they're the only democratic or Islamist organization, the only organization not funded by the United States and mm-hmm. Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you see any danger in the fact that they've been elected? I mean, a lot of people are afraid of the fact that they're, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, like they're some cloak and dagger organization.
I don't. I mean, these are people who renounced violence so long ago, and they've been starved and persecuted. I mean, the man who's been elected, Mohamed Morsi, he spent years and years in prison, never advocated violence, never advocated a guerrilla campaign, and now he became president through legitimate means. If we want to accept democracy, we have to accept the choice of the Egyptian people, regardless of who they choose. That's
sounds
what democracy
kind of similar
is.
Similar to like South Africa or something.
Most definitely is. And I think that's about it for In Context.
Okay.
And you've been listening to us on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And you find us on Facebook at In Context. And look up our website, incontextreport.com.
All right. That does it. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
Stay tuned for Rick Petrone.
Come see us at the Ridgefield, what is it, library?
Ridgefield Community Center.
Community
that's
Center.
This Wednesday, 7:30 p.m., Ridgefield, Connecticut.
See you later. Bye.
Bye-bye.